ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Most people in Australia making policy about housing don't want house prices to fall.
Oh, very simply, they cut my limbs off.
On Life Matters with me, Tegan Taylor, we crack open money, relationships and the stories shaping your life.
I'm nobody's darling, believe you me.
Big questions, real solutions. Life Matters is where your stories shape the national conversation. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's played out like a Hollywood thriller, but for Mexico, there is much more at stake.
Yes, this week, President Claudia Sheinbaum ordered an operation against one of the country's most dangerous cartels, targeting and succeeding killing its boss, El Mencho.
His killing unleashed a spasm of violence at home and a pat on the back from President Trump.
But what was her calculation? And what happens next in her beloved country?
I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. This week, Global Roaming charts the aftershocks of an earthquake, quite frankly, in the criminal world. Now, I think, Hamish, it is reasonable to call it an earthquake in the criminal world because it was an incredible decision to take on this Jalisco cartel with its head, El Mencho, who'd really been an extraordinary leader, you could say, a businessman extraordinaire. He'd really created this army force. And they took them on. And they certainly got the backwash.
I reckon a really critical bit of information for listeners on this one is that Sheinbaum has followed on from Obrador, her predecessor, and mentor's policy of what's called hugs, not bullets.
Yes.
This idea that you deal with the cartels through intelligence, through investigations, but you don't sort of go to all-out war with them because it's been so challenging for Mexican authorities to wrestle control from the cartels. And I guess the whole shadow of Venezuela, America's intervention there, the capture of Nicolas Maduro by the Trump administration hangs heavily over this picture, right?
It does.
Because Trump has won election promising to tackle the flow of drugs into the United States from Latin America, and he's made very overt threats and followed through on them against the leaders of some of these countries. And so I guess what makes me even more interested in this story right now is what it is that's influenced Sheinbaum to do this, what the role is of America, and where this then goes from here.
Look, I'll be perfectly honest, Hamish. You know, over the years, I've found the Mexico story with the sort of rise and rise of the cartels and the incredible violence, and there have been all sorts of films made about. I've stood back.
You haven't watched Narcos.
I have not watched Narcos. And I find it repulsive. Now, I mean, I'm not proud of this, but I just...
What do you mean?
I just don't let it into my head too much. I have not reported it a lot. I've left it to others to report.
Because the level of violence is so brazen?
It seems so extensive. It seems so insoluble. It seems so insoluble. And, you know, it's wrapped up, like, it's also wrapped up in this story with Cuba. Like, it's quite fascinating that one of the things that has emerged is the number of Cuban doctors who were there working in Mexico, which Trump has also pointed out to Claudia Sheinbaum. And they are also, like, the question of whether Cuba is sort of completely on its knees and whether Mexico is being seen as almost a shadow play for what might actually unfold in Cuba, with lots of people sort of in the American Republican movement sort of wanting Cuba to fall. So all of this is such a multi-headed hydra.
There must be such risk, though, for a leader like Sheinbaum, who has not been in office for long, the country's first female president. She's Jewish. To take out the leader of the most powerful cartel. Obviously, the violence has been prolific on the streets, you know, across multiple cities, multiple states. It has looked like war. This hasn't looked like some kind of ragtag drug cartel they're fighting. It's looked like a well-armed paramilitary group.
It has.
And what happens in the aftermath, I think that's not clear to me. But then on the outside, you have someone like Trump taking credit for it, saying this is what I wanted, saying that this is a win for the United States. You know, the domestic political dimension of that must be quite dangerous, must be precarious for a leader like Sheinbaum. They call it a kingpin strategy. So, you know, you can see why domestically that might work, but I think the external praise, if you like, from Trump, as well as the sharing of intelligence, and I think we're going to delve into what else there might or might not have been in terms of US support for this.
Well,
I think that's, for me, that's a really interesting dimension to this.
Like FIFA, the FIFA World Cup is due to play there on June the 11th, and they've actually got playoffs in late March. So these are we'll all start to see more of it in a different way than this is playing out. So look. She must be under huge guard. I mean, imagine how much her life is in danger.
Well, shall we go to Guadalajara to find out more?
I think we should. And we're going to speak, I'm delighted to say, to David Mora. He's a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. He's based in Mexico. He does a lot of work researching organised crime and corruption and violence. And he tries to formulate policy as to how you might move beyond this. He joined us from Guadalajara.
David Mora, welcome to Global Roaming, and it's great to be hearing you in Mexico with a bit of music in the background, which I suppose speaks to where you are.
Yeah. Well, this is Guadalajara, as you can see and as you can hear with the music on the background. The city is slowly going back to normalcy.
And at its peak, what was this like? You were there witnessing it all unfold?
Yeah. Well, I was here in Guadalajara. I woke up Sunday morning with text messages from local reporters, colleagues of mine, that were sharing, you know, some of the reports of cars being stolen, a couple of buses that had been stolen and set up on fire outside the metropolitan zone here of Guadalajara. So we started with a few reports of, you know, these road blockades, and then those increased, and it was not only outside the city, but it was a statewide, and then it was not only in Jalisco, but in other states as well. And a few hours later, it turned out that it was a coordinated response that rolled into over 20 states of Mexico. Of course, people panicked. There was a lot of misinformation, a lot of fake videos going around, but people, smartly so, they decided to, you know, not go out onto the streets. So the city was basically empty. Businesses shut down. Public transportation was shut as well. Ride-sharing applications like Uber, they closed operations. So it was basically a ghost town. And that lasted all of Sunday, Monday. By Tuesday, things were, you know, people were, you saw more people, a few cars on the street. And now that is Wednesday, the city's almost back.
And David, when Mexicans realized that El Mencho had been killed by the government, would they have expected the kind of intense retaliation that followed, what you've just described? Was that expected?
I think it was expected, Geraldine, because, I mean, we have other episodes, recent episodes, where, you know, the government decided to go directly against one criminal top boss. And this was kind of like what we had experienced before, you know, in 2019 in the city of Culiacán in Sinaloa, when they tried to capture, when they actually captured the son of El Chapo, the youngest son of El Chapo, Ovidio Guzmán, and the cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, put out this violent response that the government was actually forced to release him. So based on previous experiences, I think people read the situation rightly, and they sensed how pivotal was this moment, and that's why they reacted the way they did.
So tell us who this El Mencho is, please, and why this cartel that he governs is so powerful.
Jalisco is probably the largest and most powerful cartel criminal group in Mexico in this moment. They're certainly the most sophisticated in terms of violence, in terms of their military capacity. They're almost a paramilitary force. They have really sophisticated weapons, not only small arms, but they've also developed a pretty active pipeline of mercenaries who've taught their gang members and hitmen to build improvised explosive devices, for instance. They were the ones who brought the drone technology into Mexico, you know, repurposing agricultural and commercial drones, feeding them with bombs and using them for attacking enemies and government forces as well. So in terms of the violence they can inflict, they're certainly at the top of the list. They're also really powerful because their finances are pretty healthy. They have a deep footprint in different criminal markets in Mexico. You know, they are front runners for the production and trafficking of fentanyl and other drugs as well. They run really lucrative rackets, extortion rackets in the agricultural sector of Mexico, a huge part of the economy here. They also do so with the mining sector, and that certainly brings a lot of income to the cartel. And finally, because they have this proclivity, this readiness to engage in really in highly political attacks. So in the past, they attempted to murder, and they've actually killed really important political figures, really popular mayors, for instance. So their readiness to attack and being really violent is what puts them on top of the list of the many criminal groups that are in Mexico. El Mencho is basically the founder of this cartel. He used to be a gunman for a different cartel. And after that cartel, the Milenio cartel, splintered. It was attacked by the government. The government had a campaign against it, and it splintered in multiple smaller criminal groups. El Mencho inherited one of these criminal groups. He married with a woman who came from a very prominent criminal family, and the two of them grew that criminal cell into what Jalisco became.
David, I wonder if you could just paint a picture of what a cartel actually is, because I reckon it's changing probably from what we imagine it to be. I know they've diversified some of their assets. They're using drones, recruiting on TikTok. This seems far more sophisticated perhaps than what we might imagine. And obviously the US has designated them foreign terrorist organizations.
Right. I mean, we're far beyond the idea of cartel just being, you know, a group of people who sit on a table and decide to act jointly, to commit crimes jointly in an organized manner. The cartels right now in Mexico are really powerful structures. They're flexible structures that operate in a myriad of licit and illicit industries. We're also far beyond the point in which the drugs were the only industry where these groups, had a presence in. They have diversified in by extorting hundreds of different industries, by, you know, like smuggling migrants as well, by committing financial crimes, even by co-opting local governments. I'm basically running local governments.
Is Trump right then when he says Mexico is run by the cartels? Are we in, should we think that he's right?
I think that's an overstatement. There's a ring of truth, because there are certainly parts of Mexico in which the Mexican state and the Mexican institutions do not control the territory, but organized crime groups do. You know, I do field research constantly across Mexico, and I've been to places in which, in order for you to access, you know, to put requests in with the criminal group that operates on that specific area, and they very much can say, no, you're not allowed to come in. And it's not only outsiders like myself. There, I've also heard reports from local government officials who have to ask permission. You know, them being the government, they also have to ask permission to bring services to specific communities that are under the sway of criminal groups. But this is the rule for the entirety of Mexico. Mexico is a very complex country, and it's a very large economy. Yeah, we have over 120 million people. So saying that the entirety of the country lives under this reality is quite an overstretch.
You will have caught listeners' ears when you mentioned fentanyl, because obviously this has been such a fixation for the Trump administration. How much of what ends up in America comes from these Mexican cartels, or comes via them anyway?
Trump is right when he says that most of the fentanyl trafficked into the U.S. comes from Mexico. The story is much more complex. It comes from Mexico, yes, but it is also trafficked by American citizens in small quantities through ports of entry on the border with the U.S. But it's right. I mean, huge, very powerful organizations like Jalisco Cartel, Sinaloa Cartel, they're certainly the main producers of the highly addictive and deadly fentanyl.
So what are the politics of this inside Mexico? Because I guess there's a way of observing this, which is Sheinbaum must have looked at what happened in Venezuela, what happened to Nicolas Maduro, and thought, well, Trump's going to come for us and I better get this done. And it does seem a pretty big shift in terms of what her stated approach has been in relation to the cartels. Is that how it's playing out? Is that how it's viewed?
And also, in a way, you know, like the Financial Times says, this is a big win for her, the death of El Mencho, and it's a big risk. Now, is that also, just following on, is that the right way to think about it?
So I think the Financial Times is right. This is a big win for Sheinbaum. It is a big win for the U.S. as well. When Sheinbaum got into power, she's a very smart politician, and she knew that one of the main agenda items that was a shortcoming by her predecessor and political mentor, former President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, was the security across the country. It had worsened during the 6 years that he was in power. His approach to the problem really, at the end, allowed a lot of these groups to grow in power and in size as well. So she knew that, and she established a very different approach. Under her watch, Mexican forces have been way more confrontational against organized crime groups. But then, of course, Donald Trump was elected, and he started this political pressure campaign for Mexico to deliver bigger and bigger outcomes in the fight against cartels. So within that context, Sheinbaum has, for instance, mass incarcerated foot soldiers and mid-level gang members of many different groups. But she was lacking this sort of like big blow, you know, this main operation against the top boss criminal, which is what she did. And she proved that the Mexican army was capable of running an operation like this. So in that sense, this is clearly a political win for Sheinbaum. Now, because this is El Mencho, this is Jalisco, this is probably the top, you know, cartel boss in Mexico. By killing him, Trump can also claim credit, which is what he basically did during his State of the Union speech, saying, we killed this cartel boss. But I think at the end, ultimately, what Sheinbaum did here was sort of like corroborating that her strategy, what she brings to the table with the U.S. works, which is the two countries can cooperate, and we're cooperating as never before. But at the end, it was Mexican troops.
You're listening to David Mora of the International Crisis Group, and keep listening here on Global Roaming for our analysis of what has happened in Mexico and what comes next. Is there any reach, I wonder, of these multi-headed entities into Australia? So far away, but, you know, by the sound of it, they've got very big ambitions.
A lot of the drugs that reach far places like Australia, They get there through really sophisticated trafficking networks that are run by some of these groups. I'm not saying that every single Mexican cartel or criminal group has, you know, the reach to and is on top of, you know, these very large worldwide networks. But certainly cartels like Jalisco and Sinaloa, they operate, these wide networks through alliances with smaller local groups and local gangs. So it's not that they directly are operating with Mexican citizens, but there are alliances. Each group kind of like controls a specific moment in this very long chain of production and distribution.
What's the flow and effect of this, though, within Mexico? Do the cartels fight back? Does this become some kind of full-blown war between the cartels and the government?
There will be repercussions, definitely, very violent ones. The most immediate, you know, reaction, I think it's we're almost out of it. which was, you know, these hundreds of blockades and clashes between government forces and the cartel. That it's kind of like almost past. What's going to happen is that there's going to be a reaccommodation process within the cartel that is going to be, that potentially it has the potential to be very violent. There are different forces within the cartel that all operated under El Mencho. And now that the El Mencho is out of the photo, there are different, you know, forces that might reaccommodate and might struggle to decide who the new boss is going to be. And that instability usually brings violence. And we've seen this in many times in recent history. Just now, Sinaloa cartel has had this massive internal struggle, a very violent one, basically because one faction is trying to take control over the other one. So we might see something similar within the cartel, but also with other groups as well, because the cartel, Jalisco cartel, had really active, violent wars, turf wars against other smaller groups across Mexico. So this in this moment, those other groups, you know, Jalisco cartel enemies, might see an opportunity, might think that the cartel is weak because it has no leader at this point, and they might increase their wars. You know, they might think that this is a moment to gain the upper hand against Jalisco. And those turf wars are also very violent, and they have civilians caught in the middle. So the repercussions of these we're going to see, you know, in a few weeks and months to come, and violence might probably spike up in Mexico.
That's exactly what fascinates me about what comes next, because, I mean, this struggle you're describing, I wonder what it means for everyday Mexicans who must be being destabilized. You're really describing a society in incredible change, with this big giant next door insisting they do change. So you know, overall, where does that take the average Mexican?
So again, it's a very complex country and reality. It has multiple realities playing out at the same time. So from where I'm, you know, talking to you right now, Guadalajara, Mexico City, Monterrey, and there is a long list of cities, urban centers that we don't see the direct violence produced by the operations of these cartels. That is not to say that that there are no criminal markets operating, but, you know, not a criminal market such as the drug production and traffic and consumption doesn't necessarily bring violence. Violence comes from when these markets have multiple players trying to topple each other and gain control of the place where they operate, right? So most of the violence in Mexico is produced by clashes between two or more of these groups. So the reality for the people who live in places like Guadalajara is very different from, you know, someone who lives in a very rural area in the middle of nowhere where more than one cartel or criminal group is trying to gain control because it's a trafficking route, for instance, for either drugs or migrants, or because there's a lot of mining activity and the cartel wants to, you know, keep a fee or charge a fee of all the, you name it, gold, silver that is produced. And the reality for those Mexicans is very different. And they're really, they live under control of a criminal group. And that shows in things like, it is a criminal group, the one who decides whether there's going to be public transportation operating that day or not. It is a criminal group that is going to decide whether teachers are going to be able to come and teach their kids or not. Same with health service, for instance. So it's really living under, you know, a parallel government that very violently decides what services are available or not. And when the fighting between different groups erupts, they're also caught in between. And we're talking about very brutal, you know, with sophisticated weapons, the use of bombs is more common now, mines as well, and other improvised explosive devices. And people fall prey of this. They fall victims of this violence. And that's why the homicide rate in Mexico is so abnormally high.
If you're sitting there in one of those places that you just described, and you had particularly sons, I mean, is there any way of avoiding them being drafted into these terrible organizations?
The recruitment, the capacity of recruitment that these groups have is so vast. And they are going to, they're basically able to keep, you know, waging these wars because the bodies, There's a lot of poor folks who don't have a chance, who don't go to school, whose employment opportunities are very limited, and they just fall prey into these recruitment networks. And that is very, very sad. So there's definitely a whole agenda to be discussed with regards to, you know, who are the ones who are actually shooting these weapons.
David, you paint an extraordinary picture, and we're very grateful that you have. Thank you very much for joining us on Global Roaming.
Of course, thanks for having me.
And that was David Mora from the International Crisis Group. Gee, I tell you what, Hamish, imagine if you were sitting as a parent in those areas that are governed by the cartels. How on earth would you keep, like, you just have to get out to keep your children safe.
Well, so many have. So many have gone to America.
That's the risk, that we're going to have a big refugee outpouring if they really do take them on.
Geraldine, let's do a bit of feedback because we've had a huge flow of correspondence. Thank you very much, by the way, on our episodes with Senator Tim Kaine from the United States, who is here looking at all of Australia's AUKUS progress, but also Dr. Eli Ratner, former Pentagon official here in Australia as well. He had this sort of phrase about look in the mirror. If you are thinking about sort of walking away from the relationship with the United States, what does it say about your country if you're willing to do that?
You know, when I heard that, I thought, now what's he getting at? And then he fleshed it out, is that you've got to actually look at what it says about your own country, which was very interesting.
Well,
you certainly arced up, and I didn't blame you.
He's saying that if you think you should walk away from a decades-old, almost century-old alliance because of one president, then what does it say about the strength of your own culture and your history and your politics?
My view is that I think the Americans are getting used to the idea that the world is seriously seeing them differently, and they're not accustomed to it.
Ian's written in, he says, Australia never accepted and embraced AUKUS, as Senator Tim Kaine maintains. The detail remains secret and has never been discussed or endorsed by the Australian community, which is appalling, says Ian, given that this is the largest defence project ever entered into in this country. I'm not sure that it's not being discussed and that the details are all secret. Some of it is secret, but there is a hell of a lot of information out there.
And thanks to Liz, who said the interview, quotes, reminded me very much of Marco Rubio's speech at the security conference. His tone was very reassuring, but the content was vague and non-committal. Frankly, I found it a bit terrifying, and I am not reassured at all about AUKUS for Australia.
And Lee wrote in saying, of course there is bipartisan US support for the AUKUS project. It's a great deal for America. The Virginia-class submarines were launched in 2000 with a projected 30-year lifespan. We won't be getting any before they're obsolete. You didn't point that out. I'm not sure that's universally accepted, that sort of obsolescence argument, by the way.
No, it's not.
And there is also going to be, we're told, an AUKUS-class submarine, which is the other plank of this project.
Now, remember that we do like your compliments as much as your critiques, so keep them coming. And if you missed out on our chat with the Senator, you can catch up, of course, on ABC Listen. The episode is called US Senator Tim Kaine Makes the Case for AUKUS.
You can also find the Eli Ratner interview there. They're kind of good companion pieces, to be honest. global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Jerry, we're back Monday answering some of your questions in the Your Call episode, and
yes,
we're going to delve a bit further into Russia and Ukraine. Laura Tingle joining us.
So that's all to come next week. Thanks to the team, Jesse Kay, Aston Brown, Shane Anderson, and executive producer Kylie Morris. Enjoy the weekend.
Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.